long, hard haul, and we've gained exactly nothing so far.
The Bering Sea Crab Plan gets its report card. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 13th of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Republican U.S. Senate candidate Joe Miller takes his case over vote counting to the Alaska Supreme Court. Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Republican U.S. Senate candidate Joe Miller is taking his case to the Alaska Supreme Court. Miller's camp announced this afternoon that attorney Thomas Van Flein has filed an appeal with the state's highest court. This past Friday, a lower state court ruled against Miller in his ongoing challenge to the way in which the state elections division conducted a count of write-in ballots for Miller's rival in the race, Senator Lisa Murkowski. A federal judge had halted certification of the Senate election after resolution of the issues until after resolution of the issues raised by Miller. The Alaska Supreme Court has issued an expedited briefing schedule requesting Miller's opening brief by tomorrow and the state's opposition brief due on Wednesday. Oral arguments are scheduled for Friday. Miller is appealing portions of the lower court ruling, questioning what Miller terms a modification of state law that previously required write-in ballots to match the candidate's declaration form. Since the lower court ruling, Miller says such ballots will be counted based on an election official's interpretation of voter intent. Miller campaign spokesman Randy DeSoto says the campaign also wants a hand count of Miller's ballots. The North Pacific Fishery Management Council continued its December meeting through the weekend in Anchorage. One of the main items on the panel's plate was a look back at a Bering Sea Aleutian Islands crab management plan after 5 years. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, there's two sides to the evaluation of the success of the plan.
More formally known as the Bering Sea Aleutian Islands Crab Rationalization Plan, it was implemented in 2005 after several years of North Pacific Fishery Management Council discussion. Council members approved the plan's five-year report card on Friday, with an amendment tacked on to provide some wiggle room for future adjustments. Edward Paulson, director of the Alaska Bering Sea Crabbers, a trade group based in Seattle, is calling the Bering Sea Catch Share program an unqualified success.
You know, in terms of the financial stability of this resource, it's dramatically improved as well. We no longer have to try to make a year's worth of money in 7 to 10 days. Now vessels have much longer time that they go fishing, and that allows for vessels to make more money. We have professional crew. You know, they no longer have part-time jobs. They have full-time jobs fishing crab. That also helps to improve safety.
The industry points to the fact that since 2005, only one death and no vessel sinkings have occurred. Before that, 85 crabbers died in a six-year period before the Catch Share program went into effect. In 2002, problems with the Bering Sea crab fishery were identified by the council. Resource conservation, bycatch reduction, and excess harvesting were targeted, but a high rate of injuries and loss of life by crew were also named as fishery problems.
First and foremost, safety. You know, people had to take risks. I was out there, fishing crab in the 90s and, in the middle of 30-foot waves and freezing conditions. It was no fun. I mean, you really earned your money. It was very, very dangerous. And, there were simply some boats that should not have been out there fishing. But they had a strong incentive to go, even if they were taking huge risks.
Before the Catch Share plan, hundreds of crab vessels would participate in winter fisheries lasting days or weeks. Since the Catch Share plan started, the season has been extended while each vessel has a set amount of crab to harvest. And Paulson says remaining crew positions in the crab fisheries are more stable and crew generally make better pay. That's not so, according to some crab vessel crew members from Kodiak, who say crew members have been pushed out of the lucrative fishery by the catch share plan.
They've kind of like given it to the absentee owners to take exorbitant leases and leave crew in the dust.
It's been a long, hard haul, and we've gained exactly nothing so far.
That's crab vessel crew members Sean Docterman and Steve Branson. Branson says a crew members association has been lobbying to have more of a share for crew members for the past 7 years.
And it's just not happening. They allocated all of the crab in the Bering Sea to the boat owners, except for 3% that they gave to the skippers that worked during the qualifying years. And the crews got nothing.
The council moved this session to create a committee to have industry look into fair compensation for crew. But vessel owners who now have allocated to them all the crab in the Bering Sea customarily lease out their quotas to the one-third of the fleet that fishes, according to Branson. And the lease fees are so exorbitant that there's not much left after taxes and fuel and bait for crew members.
The boat makes $100,000. The lease fee holder takes 70 of it.
But Paulson says the catch share plan has dramatically reduced the number of crab pots used, causing less impact on crab habitat, and a smaller, more focused fleet is more eco-friendly, using less fuel. The bottom line, he says, is that the management plan had to change after the crab crashes of the early decade.
The only reason there was as many vessels fishing in the early 2000s as there was because they were anticipating a catch share program coming into place. Everyone knew this was going through the council. And that was at a time when there were no regulations. Anybody could really go crab fishing. Regulators encouraged people to go get into the crab industry by telling them, if you don't go get into the crab industry, you'll never be able to get in, because that encouraged a tremendous amount of participation in the crab fishery and in fact, created tremendous overcapitalization.
Paulson says the catch share program encourages cooperation among the fleet rather than the cutthroat competition of the past. The council plans to take up the issue of crew concerns at a meeting next year. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
State biologists have killed 14 wolves near the Alaska Peninsula community of Port Hyden. This in response to wolves killing several pets and acting aggressively toward Port Hyden residents in recent months. Residents had killed 7 wolves in August, but the bad behavior continued, and the state decided it had become a public safety issue. KDLG's Adam Kane has an update on the story.
Lynn Butler is a wildlife biologist for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and King Salmon. He says that during last week's 2-day hunt, 14 wolves were taken. With a large caribou herd still lingering in the area, he cautions that the situation might not yet be resolved.
We took 14 wolves within 6 miles of the road system last week as of Friday. So Saturday, we backed off our search. We feel that between the wolves taken along the road by local residents and the number taken by the state within 6 miles, it might reduce the issue significantly. That's 21 wolves total taken out of that small area at this point. We're waiting to hear from the village to see if they have continued problems. We expect more wolves to move in to fill the vacancy. Again, there's still caribou in the area that will draw them, but hopefully they won't display the same bad behaviors that the first set of wolves did.
Several experienced tracking pilots flew the helicopters on the hunt, and all the wolves were taken from within 6 miles of Port Hyden. Butler says that after inspecting the dispatched wolves, he didn't see any signs of malnutrition or starvation.
The wolves that we took were all healthy wolves, normal body condition, nothing to suggest a health-related issue.
Wolves are typically seen around many Bristol Bay Area communities. However, this year, the wolves near Port Hyden tended to be spotted closer to the village, and reports of aggressive behavior towards people and house pets had increased. Earlier this year, a pack of wolves was identified as having killed a teacher who had been out jogging in the Alaska Peninsula community of Chignik Lake. Butler was pleased with the recent hunting efforts of residents in Port Hyden, although he says that despite the increase in number of wolf spottings reported, attacks on humans are still uncommon.
Negative encounters with wolves are pretty rare and infrequent. They can happen. It's something to be aware of, but unlikely that we'll see many of these kind of situations. I think it's just an anomaly.
Through last week's hunt, the state intended to reduce the volume and frequency of wolf encounters near Port Hyden. If the reported sightings decrease, then the state most likely won't pursue any follow-up action in the community. Body measurements and biological samples were taken from the dispatched wolves, and a Fairbanks-based veterinarian we'll be checking those samples for diseases. In Dillingham, I'm Adam Kane.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, charter boat operators brace for possible cuts to halibut allocations.
We're concerned about failures of our businesses throughout Southeast Alaska and the impact that'll have on the local economy.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, providing insight on statewide business and government issues. There's more information online at akbizmag.com.
Alaska senators helped an effort today to advance the proposed tax cut bill currently being hotly debated in Washington. Both Senator Lisa Murkowski and Senator Mark Begich voted in favor of cloture, cutting off the chance of a filibuster and allowing the bill to move forward in the Senate. The vote was seen as a test of the deal, which was struck between President Obama and congressional Republicans and is detested by liberal Democrats. It extends all of the soon-to-expire Bush-era tax cuts, including those for the wealthiest Americans. Democrats are getting their desired extension of long-term unemployment benefits and the continuation of tax cuts for the middle class. But a deal brokered over the estate tax and the high wage-earning tax cuts has House Democrats threatening to block the plan. Despite the opposition by some in his party, Democratic Senator Begich says he likes the relief it will provide for middle-class and working Alaskans and the extension of the child tax credit, as well as a payroll tax cut for 2011. Senator Lisa Murkowski has said she supports the deal because she does not want to increase taxes for anyone when the economy is struggling. Alaska shrimpers can get up to $12,000 to improve their businesses. A federal program is offering support for fishermen hurt by competition from foreign shrimp farms and harvesters. About 300 people have commercial shrimp permits for Alaska waters, but only a third of them still fish. Most shrimpers live in Southeast Alaska. Glenn Haight of the Alaska Sea Grant Marine Advisory Program says eligible shrimpers will be trained in business planning and financial management.
We'll touch on direct marketing of shrimp products. We'll look at productions and operations considerations. You know, what kind of equipment is going to make useful products to compete in this environment? We'll look at seafood markets, look at the shrimp markets particularly, and see what the competition's up to. And then take a look at fisheries management issues, perhaps some organizational development kinds of things that might help the group as a whole.
Fishermen must have caught and landed shrimp in either the pot or beam trawl commercial fishery in 2008 to be eligible. They must also have shrimped during one of the previous 3 years. Crew and spouses may also qualify. Haight says the federal assistance could be used to purchase equipment or market shrimp.
A number of the shrimpers have turned to the local markets as an option, and so you see people selling to their towns. And that may be something we could see a little bit more of. And beyond that, I think there's probably some other opportunities in the export market that we'll explore with people.
Those interested in the program must apply by December 23rd. Haight says only about 10 Alaska fishermen have signed up for the program so far. Links are at our website, aprn.org. The guided sport fishing industry is bracing for potential impacts from next month's annual meeting of the International Pacific Halibut Commission. As commissioners consider a 47% cut to the halibut limit for commercial longliners in Southeast, they'll also look at more restrictions on the charter fleet. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
As they face another deep cut to their quota for the sixth year in a row, Southeast commercial fishermen are calling on the International Pacific Halibut Commission to keep the charter sector from exceeding its guideline harvest level again. Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association Director Linda Bankin is concerned the overage could lead to further commercial quota cuts.
The quota that's been recommended relies on the charter industry being held to their GHL, which they haven't been held to since the GHL was set in 2004. If the IPHC is concerned that those ongoing overages will place undue burden on the resource, there may be an additional cut to compensate for that.
The U.S.'s North Pacific Fishery Management Council has already approved a new catch-sharing plan aimed at keeping the charter fleet to a preset allocation, but the National Marine Fisheries Service does not expect it to be in place until 2012. Earlier this year, the Halibut Commission raised concerns the plan was taking too long, so it directed its staff to come up with a set of its own restrictions to consider for 2011.
The Commission does have very strong concerns about this in terms of conservation issues for the stock.
According to IPHC Director Bruce Lehman, staff will suggest the Commission look at the same types of measures that regulators have discussed in the past.
They're along the same lines in terms of bag limits and line limits and that sort of thing, Matt. So we're not interested in sort of reinventing the wheel in terms of recommendations to the Commission.
The Southeast Charter Fleet has already been under a one halibut per client per day rule since 2009. That's down from the normal sport fish limit of two. Halibut guides in Southeast worry about any additional restrictions that could be in store for their industry. Sitka charter fisherman and lodge owner Tom Ohouse is president of SEGO, the Southeast Alaska Guides Organization.
You know, obviously, first, we're concerned about the resource. And secondly, we're really concerned about what, the result of less than one fish per day limits in our own industry, which has been very, very hard hit by, we're now into our third year of recession. And we've also been hard hit by differential regulations with other areas. Our regulations have gone from two to a day to one a day. And there's, you know, we're concerned about failures of our businesses throughout Southeast Alaska and the impact that'll have on local economies.
The Southeast charter fleet could be substantially smaller this coming year as a new limited entry system goes into effect. It's tough to predict what will happen as a result of limited entry, according to Ohouse, but he thinks it will have a fairly significant impact on catches. The commission's annual meeting, when it decides on the commercial catch limits and other recommendations, starts January 25th in Victoria, British Columbia. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
There's a new public transportation option in the Fairbanks area. The borough is making four vans available for groups of people to commute to work. The borough is contracting with Michigan-based VPSI for the service. The company runs van pools in Anchorage and many other communities across the country. Alaska VPSI project manager Chrissy Ditmore says a van pool is similar to a carpool.
You have a group of people who live in one area and work in one area, and they say as a group, we're going to come together as volunteers and we're going to agree to whatever schedule they decide they want to do. So highly flexible.
Ditmore says each van pool selects a couple of participants to be drivers, and they get trained by VPSI. Drivers and the borough are not liable for accidents, but Ditmore adds that AAA has found van pooling to be the safest form of commuter transportation. Insurance and vehicle maintenance are covered by VPSI. Ditmore says van pool participants share the cost of gas and pay a monthly charge. Ditmore says the average Alaska van pool rider saves about $10,000 a year in commuting costs. Borough Transportation Director Glenn Miller says the van pool option is trying to meet demand for public transit outside the borough bus routes. He says van pooling should be well suited to a few Fairbanks residential areas and work destinations.
Chena Hot Springs Road, Fox, Goldstream Valley, even Fort Knox, the military bases such as Eielson. There's a lot of people that work on Eielson Air Force Base. That same thing. They're just going the other way, but they follow each other to work and follow each other home every day.
Miller says the vans are set up for comfortable commuting with captain's chairs and reading lights. The borough is starting small with just four vans purchased with a federal economic recovery grant, but officials say the program can grow. The company's Ditmore says the Anchorage van pool has doubled to more than 50 vans in the last 5 years.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a pre-existing medical condition, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the new temporary federal insurance program being administered by ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The program is for those with qualifying pre-existing conditions and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months. talk to an independent insurance broker, or go online to achia.com. This message sponsored by Achia Fed.
A military probe has concluded that pilot error was to blame for the crash of a giant C-17 cargo plane after takeoff from Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson last July. All four on board the aircraft died. Investigators are not saying which of the four was piloting the plane, which stalled after making too abrupt a turn after takeoff from the base. The plane was too low to have room to recover and hit the ground. The casualties were Major Michael Freyholtz of Hines, Minnesota, Major Aaron Malone of Anchorage, Captain Jeffrey Hill of York, Pennsylvania, and Master Sergeant Thomas Sicardo, an Alaska Air National Guardsman from Anchorage. The military wants to create a new 125,000-square-mile training range in the interior and Gulf of Alaska. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The U.S. military says it needs more space and different terrain in order to train for 21st century warfare. So the Alaskan Command is proposing changes to training ranges around Fairbanks, Eielson Air Force Base, and Fort Greely that are all part of the 67,000-square-mile Joint Pacific-Alaska Range Complex. The command also is proposing adding a larger military operations area north and south of the Denali Highway, extending nearly to the Glen Highway around Sutton, and it would expand access to training areas and allow development of new ranges, facilities, restricted airspace, and airspace corridors. If the federal government approves the proposal, it also would add 58,000 square miles of open ocean and airspace in the Gulf of Alaska for more naval exercises. Air Force Captain Uriah Orland, an Alaskan command spokesman, says the resulting 100,000 square mile Joint Pacific Alaska Range Complex is needed to enable personnel and equipment from all the armed services to train jointly under realistic conditions.
When we're deployed to Afghanistan or Iraq or wherever we are, we fight together as a single team, as a joint team. And to prepare for that battle scenario that we have, it's imperative that we train that way as well. And that's really what we're developing and trying to push for, is that the Army and the Air Force train together so that they, you know, while the Army is doing ground maneuvers, the Air Force is doing close air support and that support overhead, just like they do in Afghanistan or wherever they may be.
The Alaskan Command's proposal notes that Alaska already has several large training ranges surrounded by vast areas of open country that's generally sparsely populated, and it has a clean and uncluttered electromagnetic environment and a strategic location. But there's no guarantee the Alaskan Command's proposal will be approved in its present form. The military has completed initial studies with findings on the expansion's anticipated impact on aviation, wildlife, and other resources, and access to backcountry, to name a few. The military is now beginning to compile an environmental impact statement on the plan, and as part of that, it's soliciting public input. The Alaskan Command has scheduled 7 public meetings on the proposal to be held in mid-January around the state. Those include 4 meetings in the interior, 1 in Delta Junction on January 19th, 2 in Fairbanks on January 20th, and 1 in Healy on January 24th. The Navy is seeking further public comment on the environmental impact statement for its part of the proposal when the service's EIS is issued sometime this month. The Navy held its public meetings on the proposal in January of this year. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Federal officials are considering changes to management of native sacred sites in national forests. A year-long review stems from conflicts in the lower 48, but the new policies could affect burial sites and other locations in Alaska. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Tribal groups have fought for years over protection of sacred sites on Forest Service land. One of the biggest battles was at a northern Arizona ski area where recycled wastewater was used to make snow on a sacred mountain. Another was in Nevada, where a sacred rock was being used for recreational climbing. Forest Service officials recently decided to get fresh input from tribal groups as they consider how those decisions are made. John Autry of the Tongass National Forest Tribal Relations Program says meetings are already taking place.
We understand it is critical to incorporate Alaska Native perspectives and values and to mutually determine what guidelines and policies we can both live with.
Listening sessions, here and nationwide, began in November and will continue for several months. Autry, who's based in Ketchikan, says recommendations will be developed, then go back to tribal leaders before any decisions are made. The effort will take about a year. The process for protecting and managing sacred sites is somewhat different in Alaska than for the lower 48. Steve Kessler, a Forest Service official based in Anchorage, says that's due to the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act.
Some of the key areas of historical and cemetery-type interest for the tribes have been actually set aside through withdrawal, through selection and conveyance to the regional corporations. And so, to some degree, there may be less of a concern in Alaska than in some of the rest of the country.
Forest Service leaders in Washington say any policy changes must allow the agency to fulfill its various missions. Those include natural resources development and recreation. The Forest Service has reviewed its sacred sites policies before. Autry says a similar process 6 years ago led to changes in Tongass planning documents. Prince of Wales Island and Angoon leaders have already been contacted, and meetings are planned with other groups in and near Southeast's Tongass and South Central's Chugach National Forests. A four-member Alaska Tribal Leaders Committee is also part of the review. Kessler says the sacred sites process will include a variety of people.
It's not just tribes that are necessarily the keepers of sacred sites. It's other people also that often know about where these sacred sites are and are the ones that the Forest Service, need to be consulting with.
The process is separate from Sea Alaska's land selection legislation. Bills in Congress propose turning tens of thousands of acres of Tongass land over to the regional Native corporation. That includes a number of sacred sites. This is Ed Schoenfeld.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Adam Kane in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tim Ellis in Delta, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, and Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. It's almost time to file online for your PFD, and when you do, you can make an impact by sharing just a little with a cause you care about. Celebrate the arts, invest in education, shelter a homeless pet, lend a hand, or even make a wish come true when you pick, click, give to one of Alaska's nonprofits. Visit pickclickgive.org to decide how you will make Alaska better with a small gift from your PFD. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.